Kanga Audio.
If you enjoy the stories on this podcast, you'll also like the stories in my book, Filmmaking Confidential, which isn't just for filmmakers, but also all artists and really any entrepreneur. Now an Amazon.com and Audible.com bestseller. I just want to say thank you to all of you who ordered it. If you haven't yet picked it up, it's available wherever books are sold in most countries around the world. Order it by visiting Audible or Amazon. To find out more, check out filmmakingconfidential.com and stevebalderson.com. And thank you. I'm Steve Balderson, and you're listening to the Filmmaking Confidential podcast. Every week, we meet with filmmakers, writers, actors, artists, and other notables. Today's guest is musician Eric Hyman. After releasing and selling his music independently through his record label, Thumb Crown Records, licensing original music to MTV, E, and heavy rotation on Sirius XM satellite radio, Eric Hyman has sustained a successful independent career for over two decades.
I started playing guitar when I was 8. I mean, was I a prodigy? No. My dad put a guitar in my hand at 8, and I fumbled with it for a few years before I really found its use for me. Yes. I had a working knowledge of knowing how to play it, but at 13, I was able to start applying it. And I was never one to play with toys, even as a small child, but I was always fascinated with musical instruments. And I was always fascinated, like, people were collecting baseball cards. I remember at some point I was collecting, like, music cards. They were, like, little baseball-looking cards, but, you know, one of them would be, like, heart. It would be, like, bands would be on them. And I would collect that. I was obsessed with music and buying tapes. Having, like, a big tape collection to me was something to be heralded. So music had always been very much like that for me. Right. Singing has been something that was more of took me a second to really wrap my brain around style and what I wanted to do and where I wanted to be. Whereas guitar was, and people would usually say, like, oh, wow, Eric, you're a really good guitar player. And I'd be like, oh, I'm kind of bummed you said that. They'd be like, why? And I'd say, because I feel like the guitar, all I'm really trying to do with it, you know, is to just back up my vocals. And half the time, like, I'm grabbing this guitar to show you, half the time, I don't even know, like, I don't realize how, like, busy I'm playing with it. I'm just thinking of, like, what's coming out here and providing enough space behind it to put something so it doesn't seem weird that I'm singing and it's not fully backed. I was always trying to use the guitar as, like, a drum and a bass line and just very full, very much like, you know, Ani DiFranco or Richie Havens, very percussive guitar players.
Totally. I get that. And also, I love, because your music is so percussive, it becomes very cinematic. You know, like there's this rhythm, there's this forward rhythm. So when I hear your music, I'm imagining the way that a film is cut, you know, the way that a scene flows, or the way that a sequence moves.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I write trying to envision what I'm talking about. You know, I write trying to provide enough of a backdrop, like with lyrics, to provide a description as to what I'm trying to say. It's never like, I miss you, I hate you, I love you, I blah, blah, blah. Like, I really do spend some time trying to figure out how can I say what I want to say and give people the visual in a few amount of words. And that, to me, sometimes is hard. That's like the puzzle of writing music, that to me is sometimes the most fun, is to have those boundaries. Of I only have two lines and I have to get from A to B. You know, how do I do that? That to me is the fun challenge of writing music.
When I'm writing a script or something, I do something similar. And it's sort of like the layers of the onion of, well, here's what I'm saying or what I mean, you know, behind it. But then trying to bury that under something that's a little bit more vague or a little bit less descriptive, you know, something that isn't quite on the nose.
My manager friend Cass used to yell at me all the time. She used to say, I would go play her a song, and if she couldn't figure out immediately what it was about, she used to say, like, you know, ballpark. Like, I kind of know, I know you well enough to know what you're trying to say, but does it stand alone and people get the direct meaning of what you're trying to say? No, you're close, but like, you're too far out, you know? And I always valued that. It's like, okay, good. At least somebody, because that's to me is sometimes the hard part about being a writer, whether it's writing music, writing movies, writing books. You know, there was a time where I was doing stand-up comedy, still kind of doing it, and writing jokes. It's the same thing. It's like, you know where you want things to go. You know where the setup is. You know where the punchline is. You know where it wants to land. But you know yourself sometimes so well that I feel like some people kind of trip over themselves thinking, oh, of course everybody knows what I mean when I say blah, blah, blah. But then the average person is like, no, you have to lead me there. I think our minds sometimes skip steps because you're just so familiar with yourself and your own mind. You take for granted sometimes that people will just follow you wherever you go. I think that's when some people's work, if you notice, like, you know, directors or musicians, when they go and do another album or another movie and it doesn't hit the same way as maybe other things that were like a straight line, then people are like, oh, like they get too much in their own bubble.
Sure. No, totally. So, I get that. And, you know, one thing might be, I mean, for me as an artist, tell me if this is similar for you anytime, but like, you know, it's like, I might be interested in exploring a topic or a genre or a feeling or a tone or a thing that may be very, very different from something I've already done. I may be successful at finding out what that is and exploring this area, or it could just be totally not for me, you know, but I won't know that until it's finished. You know, it's like you finish the movie and you show it and they're like, interesting.
Which is hard because when you think of songs, I mean, a song lasts, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. A movie is like, I was watching like the holiday movies that made us. And it was two movies. One was Elf and one was The Nightmare Before Christmas. And watching the one about The Nightmare Before Christmas, which is stop motion, and the amount of time, I mean, I know it takes time to make stop motion films. We all do. But the amount of time that to actually see it in progress and to hear how long it takes to make a minute worth of that film, and then how many years it takes to make films like that, and then it doesn't hit the same way, and the expectations, I'm like, I mean, I write a song and maybe I spent a few weeks on it. I can't imagine making a stop motion film for years and then presenting it and someone go, interesting.
Yeah.
You know, which is one of the reactions that they were saying about, like, one of the people that worked on the film said, yeah, people, you know, kind of like they didn't get it. They get it now. It's like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the first one, you know, that just doesn't hit initially, but then it somehow works later on in life. But it's always funny when you put that much time and effort into pointing yourself and thinking that, yeah, I'm doing this, I'm getting right. And then someone's like, I hate that about art.
Of course. Well, it's taught me a lot about how to appreciate all kinds of art.
Oh,
you know, I never say anything's good or bad because I just look at what is, you know,
that's and a good point.
That is thing, whatever, however it is, may not be for me, but it's not necessarily bad. It's just not for me.
Yeah.
And so at least it's helped me sort of be less judgmental when I take in new art, or like if I'm going to watch something and, you know, I might shut it off halfway through, but I wasn't judgmental about it. I just put myself into a position where it's like, well, I'm just not going to continue exploring this movie or this album or this, you know, whatever it is. And I have the power to turn it off, you know, instead of being all worked up about it. I just wish most people would do that. But okay, so when did you become a professional, or at least take it seriously, becoming a singer, songwriter, and performer?
Well, I played in college in like cover bands. And then started writing my own music and recorded an album in 2000. And I think not until 2002, when I started touring around, did I really go, oh, this is what I can do or what I am. I think those are the moments when you feel like you're doing something and it's not immediately successful, but then the next day you still have to do it again. That's when I felt like, all right, I'm professionally doing this. I would have a gig and it wouldn't go very well. And then the next night I would play somewhere and it would be a little bit better. And then, I mean, it was always just like, I mean, it still is, but like always is fluctuating in that way. where your expectations and what it ends up being, I got better at trying to match them. And then that's when I felt like I'm all right, I'm doing this as a career.
Did you have people to advise you along?
No.
That time?
No. And I feel like that sometimes I struggled with, and even my manager and I, Cass, like, and I, we struggled with it because there was nobody to just mentor me or grab, you know, and say, hey, like, what happened? Cause it was like, I was slowly building a career. And when you're looking around, everybody's either super competitive or too busy to doing their own thing. And I didn't know famous people. I didn't have famous people in my family. I didn't have any entertainer types to really give me some kind of advice. In fact, I almost got worse advice from everybody who didn't know that business, you know, where family members were like, oh, give up, like get a desk job. Like, you can't do this forever. Like, you know, it was constant. I didn't have anybody to say, okay, you need somebody in booking to help you do this. Oh, you need somebody to manage your copyrights. Or, you know, like, there was no one to do those things. And when I did come up against a few types who saw my talent and said, all right, you know, I want to work with you. And then it just wasn't working out. You know, I had a company in Florida, like these two producers I was starting to work with who worked with like Crosby, Stills and Nash. It was like someone's uncle or aunt had a connection to these people. And I somehow got to meet them and they were like, oh, we'd like to work with you. And then I sat down to work with them. You know, they're kind of more pointing what I, you know, you should be more of a John Mayer type. And here's the kind of content we think you should be doing. And I got that level of mentorship or some kind of people in the business who were trying to help me in that way. But then there would always be some weird catch where they would be sitting with me and or my manager at the time. And she would say, Eric is on this new CD, Love Rocks, which the HRC is putting out. It's like him and the Dixie Chicks and Cyndi Lauper and like all these, you know, big names, Pink, all these people that are on it. This is like in 2002. And he said, what's the HRC? And she said, you know, it's, you know, LGBT rights and yada, 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 yada. And then he goes, let me know when you get that fag CD. And that there was always some weird, crappy thing that would happen like that. And then I would walk away because I'm like, I can't. I mean, I know there were moments I should have been like, oh, well, you know, this industry better than I do. I'm going to like get all the information out of you as I can. But when I had people acting like that around me, when I was obviously out, you know, had no reason to feel any sort of way about it, I thought, if all they're looking at me is like that, how can I creatively exist in this space? Mm-hmm. So then I quit, you know, and went and did my own thing.
Was that the first and last time that you were less independent than other times?
Another time I had somebody who was trying to point me in that direction. And then it just became more and more money. Like, oh, we need more money. Oh, we need more money. Oh, we need more money. It's like, we're not even producing anything yet. And it just got so much bigger. And I couldn't independently play a game that I wasn't attached to a label. That was where I kind of struggled, is there were moments where being grassroots was like, I can do this on my own. I don't need anybody. And that was the 2002 moment with the fag CD thing. And then in 2012 or 2013, right after the movie, I was supposed to go out to LA and it all kind of fell apart. You know, the money fell through that the investor guy was going to put in. It was just one of those Hollywood type things where it looked like, oh, I'm working with all these amazing musicians. I recorded a song with like Alanis Morissette's band at Jim Henson Studios. I'm like on La Brea. Like I'm doing all these like with the Jonas Brothers. I'm around all this Hollywood stuff. And then the money fell through with this investor dude and it just kind of all vanished. And then I turned around and went and did it all on my own again and had a successful album with Gracefully. But I mean, it's like any industry that's art-based, is it's so tough to play ball and not, and in the end, not be independent.
Here's Eric's title track to his album, Gracefully.
I wish that I could just tell you that this world before. I was ready to let you go. And I hear you whisper, don't worry. And I'd hear you say, I'll see you in heaven. Well, heaven is where we will meet. And we'll be together like we were meant to be. But for now I must live my life like you taught me.
When did you start Thumb Crown Records, which is your label?
I started in 2000 with my first album. And then I kind of really understood what having a label meant probably in like 2005, when I was getting a lot more press. And then other people were like, oh, you should talk to my friend, you know, or like, oh, hey, I'm going to get this person interested in you. And then I realized the value of being on my own and having my own imprint, you know?
Was there anybody else, another musician or another person, that you looked at what they were doing and sort of used that model and applied it to what you were doing?
There were a lot of people that were doing that model, which was like, you know, Ani DeFranco, of course, Jonathan Brooke, a lot of folky people, you know, Ellis Paul, Patty Griffin. Like, there were just a ton of musicians on that level that I felt were perfect templates. You know, I would play these clubs. I learned like what the club circuit was, you know, World Cafe Live in Philadelphia and the Bitter End in New York City and like all these spots. And then you would go and play there and you'd see all the tour posters of the people that had gone from that level to the next level. And then you'd be like, how do I get to that level? And you would watch their careers. I didn't personally know them. Some of them I know now, but at the time I didn't know them when I really was like itching to know as much as I could about it. Like, how do you get in the door? Like, how do you open for people? How do you, you know, get on a tour with somebody and stay on a tour with somebody? How do you get a record label? How do you get a manager? How do you get a booking person? Like, there were a lot of questions and I was always like almost there, but not. And I didn't have, other than Cass and I trying to do it independently, there weren't a lot of people that were like, oh, let me pluck you from the realm. And I think that took me all the way until 2014, where I had like a big year and I was touring with Leon Russell before he died, and Ani DeFranco and Patty Griffin and Edwin McCain. And like, just had felt like, all right, now I'm seeing all these people and I'm talking to them. You know, it was like, I thought, oh, you know, especially with Ani, I thought, oh, wow. Like now I'm at this level. And it really was not like that. It was like, they said, oh, awesome. It was, you know, I love your music. You're awesome. It was like, nobody owes you anything. I thought I was walking up to a staircase. And when I pulled the curtain to the next staircase, it was just a brick wall. And then I had to realize, like, Leon let me go on tour with him and open for him. Ani did the same thing. You know, I stayed in contact with these people and like had great, got to open for them time, you know, over and over. And they don't owe me. They're not going to be like, oh, I'm going to call yada, yada, yada and get you on, you know, Jimmy Fallon. Like, that's not their job. You know, their job is just like my job. Oh, wow. I really like your music. I really like playing with you. You know, it's so awesome to work with you. If I ever need anything from you again, I'll let you know. Like, there's just not I feel like sometimes a rational thought of like, oh, well, someone's just going to help me. You know, I learned it's more about taking the moments that you do have the time in front of people and collecting all those moments and then doing it on your own and trying to get yourself there. I feel like that's more of the consistent, much more rational thought process of trying to be successful as a musician or so anybody in the arts.
Musician Eric Hyman. Another fantastic guest is Her Royal Highness, the Princess of Hollywood, Pleasant Gaiman.
And then I also one time brought Kurt Cobain to a Mexican tranny bar, and he was wearing pajamas and no one knew it was him because it was a Mexican drag bar, you know.
You can hear my full interview with Her Highness at filmmakingconfidential.com or by subscribing for free to this podcast. Coming up, Eric shares some great advice for all independent artists. Stay with us. I'm Steve Balderson, and you're listening to the Filmmaking Confidential podcast. Now, back to our conversation with Eric Hyman.
You do have the Trial and Eric cooking show that you did. When did you start that?
I started that in 2014, 15, around that time.
Yeah. And then you have a cookbook.
I had two cookbooks, yeah.
It's amazing.
Hey, it's like one thing is born out of the other. You know, when you find it, people are interested in something, you're like, all right, well, I know how to do this thing. How can I put it into some kind of way to profit off of it to continue it on as a piece of my career?
Did you have anybody in your immediate family who were entrepreneurial as much as you are?
No. My dad was in the military. My grandmother did odd jobs, but was more in New York City doing like photography assistant stuff. My grandfather sold shoes. My other grandfather was an optometrist. My mom didn't work, and you know, and they're all lawyers on the other side. It's just like, nobody was, I'm going to go out into the world and make it my own kind of thing. Even like the people after, you know, that are younger than me, they're all kind of doing jobs that are not as entrepreneurial as what I was doing. And it was sad because sometimes it looked like I was this recluse, you know, like I remember telling my grandmother on my mom's side, who I love dearly. She just actually called me my grandma Ellie, and she has a very thick New York accent. And she, you know, I started getting tattoos and I was touring around being a musician and I was out, you know, and she just looked at me like, I don't know how she put it. She was like, I don't know anybody who looks like you. She was just so like, who are you? Like, she was very confused how I could have a career, how I could, that, you know, even she would come to my shows in New York City and be like, oh my God, I can't believe these people come and see you. You know, it was like she couldn't wrap her brain around, you know, she couldn't wrap her brain around like, how does this work? You're not sitting in a place from 9 to 5 every day. You're not chained to a desk. Like, how could you possibly keep this up? You know? So it was interesting dealing with that element from a familiar standpoint.
Did they tell you to just stop it and get a real job?
Yeah. Yeah, they did. At times they did. But I think they were more supportive when I started taking them to the things that were cool that I got to do. You know, I would be on Sirius XM Coffee House, and I would go up to Sirius XM, and then there would be, you know, like Howard Stern on one side, Rosie O'Donnell was up there, Martha Stewart, you know, like those types. And then I would go in and record some music, and then I would invite them to come with me, or I would be playing Joe's Pub, you know, in New York City.
Yeah.
With them, and you know, with Levi, and Levi was on Broadway at the time, my friend Levi Christ, you know, and then I would take them to go see Billy Porter in Kinky Boots, and then afterwards go and talk to Billy, who's a friend of mine. You know, it was like things like that right. I would bring them along. And I think those elements made them feel like, all right, you know, maybe this is a little more legitimate than I thought it was.
You left a poison. Yeah. Lonely. I don't care if you were brave. I don't care about the things that you say.
Have you ever considered signing another artist to be released under your label?
No, because I really, maybe 10 years ago when CDs were as profitable as they are, like I would find the investment to come back. But so far I haven't seen anybody that I would be like, oh, I want to throw all I have behind this person. Not that there aren't people worthy of it. I just haven't met that person that made me feel like, all right, you know, there's something here. But yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. I think sometimes that's the difference between what you do and what I do is my job sometimes feels so singular. Whereas I wonder if somehow in your job, you're surrounded by people. Like you need a lot of people to put on a film. Right. Whereas music wise, it's like I could just record myself and be done. It's a very isolated, singular experience. I mean, it can be more than that, but I can get away with it being just that one thing.
Although I did do it once when I did that documentary called Phone Sex.
Yep. I knew you were going to say that.
And it was literally me sitting at, and for those of you who don't know what Phone Sex is, I was really, really upset and cranky one day because I had just had enough of the bureaucracy of trying to like raise money for a movie and get, you know, investors involved. And I was just sitting at my desk and I thought, what can I do right here by myself, you know? And I thought, well, sex sells and I'm going to invite everybody to call and leave a voicemail on my answering machine describing what is sexy. And then I'm going to take all of those answers and I'm going to string them together behind visuals that I'm going to, you know, photographs that I've taken or just doctored up stuff from online. And
it's very creative.
You have sold on your own independently over 40,000 CDs. Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
Thanks. I mean, it's over a period of, you know, 15 years. You know, so I mean, it sounds like a lot, but if you think about it, you're just constantly buying CDs and selling them and buying them and selling them and buying them and putting out numerous albums. So, I mean, it was 40,000 of CDs that are, you know, part of them are this album, part of them are that album. It's not one particular album, but to have that many out there in the world, it's like, it's cool. Like people constantly send me DMs on Instagram and Facebook and they, you know, oh my gosh, remember when I bought these 5 CDs from you? Like I literally had that happen yesterday, you know, where some guy took a picture of it and sent it to me. And I thought, that's really cool. Like, you know, somebody would come up to the merch table and I would do a deal where you could get like 5 of them for $50 or like 5 of them for $30 or something like that. And people would buy them and listen to them. And I was just trying to get it in people's hands, you know? So to have that many sold independently, I mean, I don't know about today's standards because it's, you know, everything's so Spotify numbers and iTunes number based. But to me, that felt very successful that I could just keep doing it. You know, I think I remember somebody said to me, you know, in 2008, like what advice do you have for people in this industry who are just starting out? And I thought, you know, it's easy to go from 0 to 60. You know, get a website, you know, put your music on this thing or da da da, record here, go do this. It's the longevity of your career that I think is really where it gets to be tough. It's like any relationship. It's like love. It's like anything. It's easy to get from 0 to 60. It's easy to fall in love. It's easy to start something. It's easy to get excited about something and be new and fresh. But it's really, really, really challenging to maintain and continue and grow. You know, as long as I've been doing this and as long as you've been doing this, you know, to be able to still have the passion and energy and funds and just to continue that going. I mean, that's the real essence of being an artist, is to be an artist that can survive.
Do you know the bell curve?
Yes.
Okay. So for those of you who don't know, this middle part where I've just put the X, that's like Walmart, MGM, you know, Target, yeah. Like that's like the biggest success. Stars in the world. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
There is though, you know, over here on the side, it is totally possible to exist and live in that space.
Oh yeah.
And make a great living and have a nice life. You know, it's possible. In fact, there are many industries that exist there.
Oh, I think that's what people didn't understand as a musician, you know, that everyone thinks that your goal is to be Walmart. I remember when I was done touring with Ani, you know, people would be like, oh, what's next now? I'm like, well, I don't know what's next. That was like, that was the top of that bell curve for me. It was like, the bell curve didn't go all the way up like that. The bell curve just went there. And for me, not saying anything about Ani, I love her, but like, for me, that was as big as my dream went in that way. I mean, I don't want to play stadiums. I don't have these big dreams of being Beyonce. Like my dreams are, don't have to be that big, but yet still I can still do it and still be a musician and still make money at it, which I still am, and still putting out albums, which I am. I'm like, the fact that I don't give up on it, you know, to me is just as important as, you know, other people constantly coming up to me going, you know, when are you going to be on American Idol? And when are you going to be on a da, 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 da? Like, you know, I'm good is what I used to say. Like, I don't have to be on those things in order to continually do this for a living.
Right. And when you are an entrepreneur and you are an artist, you have to do it. Even if you weren't being successful, like you still have to do it. It's in your blood. It's in your DNA. Right.
Oh yeah. That's, I mean, one of my albums I comically said was, I called it Supposed Unknown, because I just felt like everybody, because I wasn't living on that giant of a plane, like everybody was constantly like discovering me. Even though I had been around for like 10 plus years, I was still unknown. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, how does somebody do something for so long and everybody look at them like they just started yesterday? Like, exactly. Oh, are you a starving artist? I'm like, no, I'm not starving. I mean, I'm not living it up, but I'm not starving.
Right.
You know? So yeah, you're right. You can be definitely be in that bell curve area and still be fine and have moments where you kind of like touch on bigger projects, but live there and happy to.
Musician Eric Hyman. You can find Eric's albums, cookbooks, and other merch by visiting erichyman.com. Tune in next time for more Filmmaking Confidential. It is totally free to subscribe, and when you subscribe, you'll get upcoming new episodes automatically, and you'll have free access to all our past shows. The Filmmaking Confidential podcast is a production of Dakanga Audio and produced by myself and Ella Spencer. Our theme music is composed by Kevin Robles. For more of the Filmmaking Confidential podcast, head over to filmmakingconfidential.com. To learn more of my filmmaking secrets, be sure to pick up a copy of the book, Filmmaking Confidential, available on Audible, paperback, and ebook, wherever books are sold. I'm Steve Balderson. Thanks for listening and spreading the word. Until next time, keep making, keep doing, keep going.